to start my talk. Okay, my talk is divided into two parts. So the first part is I'm going to go over my favorite worms and say what we've learned about worm design from their failings. And then in the second part, I'm going to shift to talking about the future worms, which are coordinated worms. I'm going to tell you all about how to write coordinated worms. And right in the middle, I'm going to talk about the Superworm Manifesto, which is my list of points for designing better worms that can do more damage and worse things to the internet. So if the first part's boring, stay for the second part because it's different. Okay, so there we go. Okay, here are the worms that I'm going to discuss briefly. These are my favorite worms, but they all suck. This is the basic point of my talk, is that the worms that are out there are just really bad. In fact, a lot of them weren't even meant to be bad. They're just, the damage that they cause is a side effect because they were badly designed and badly written. Okay, so this is not in the same order. So here are my notes. Okay, Code Red. Code Red, everybody knows Code Red because it, you know, produced so much traffic. But, you know, it wasn't supposed to because it was a benign worm. And the problem is that it used a random scanning technique. A lot of the worms use random scanning. And the problem with random scanning is that every single worm, they're all doing random scanning simultaneously, and so there's a whole lot of overlap. And in fact, there's, as the worm progresses in its infection, the amount of overlap increases, so the amount of wasted bandwidth increases. Okay, so, right, so the Code Red is pretty much the worst worm on my list, and that's because it used random scanning, didn't use permutation scanning. Also, it broadcasts its address randomly to people. So even if you don't see in your logs that you have Code Red, other people see in their logs that you have Code Red, and then they let you know. So it's not very, very stealthy at all. And all of the damage that it did was through its inefficient use of bandwidth. It was originally meant to be benign. Now, Code Red 2 was better because it also included subnet scanning. So you have two different methods of infection, one for the internet and one for subnets, which is much more efficient. Let's see, NIMDA. NIMDA was a multi-vector, so it could propagate over email, it could propagate over web pages, it could push itself to web servers, and it could propagate between network shares, and it used Code Red 2 backdoors to propagate itself. So that was very nice because it was multi-vector, but it was also not very stealthy in that you could just look at your web server logs, you could say like, oh, look, I have NIMDA, and also it broadcasts itself, its source to random people, and so people could say, look in their logs and say, oh, look, you have NIMDA. It did have less load than Code Red because of the fact that it trojaned rather than propagating itself actively as a daemon. So the only time that NIMDA propagates is when you download it off a web page or you download it from, you know, from your email. Then, you know, boom, it propagates. Okay, so next on my list is Slapper. Slapper was the Linux worm, and there were three variants of Slapper: Slapper A, Slapper B, also known as Cynic, and Slapper C, also known as Unlock. And then there was also Slapper C2. And the interesting point about Slapper is that all three variants, Slapper A, Slapper B, and Slapper C, all use the same vulnerability. And it wasn't patched, and so they were able to have three different versions released at different times. And the last one, Slapper C2, propagated about as much as Slapper A, because the amount of new servers that are coming up was about equal to the amount of servers that were being patched. Let's see. Slapper nodes join together in a peer-to-peer network controlled by the author of the worm. This is very fascinating to me because this is where I'm going in the end towards coordinated worms. Now, the infection wasn't coordinated. The infection was, you know, random, just like Code Red, very uncoordinated. But once the worms propagated, then they link together into this peer-to-peer network, and the person who controls the worm, which they assume is the same as the author of the worm, but I have a feeling that maybe the different variants of Slapper were actually people took the code and patched it themselves, and there were multiple people operating Slapper variants simultaneously. So the controller of the worm could send Slapper code updates and have it execute arbitrary programs, which is very useful. Most worms are designed with a particular goal in mind, usually just mindless propagation. Sometimes, like code red, they wake up at a certain time and then denial of service somebody. That's usually what people do with worms, denial of service IRC servers of their friends who they're mad at. But Slapper, you know, was updatable after the fact, which was very nice. The problem with Slapper was that you have three different variants of the worm all simultaneously competing for the same space. Slapper A and B are both trying to affect the same machines. And you had this problem with code red was competing against itself, and then it would infect the same machine multiple times. Okay, Sapphire, also known as Slammer. That was just brilliant. You gotta love Sapphire because it propagated in a single UDP packet that it broadcast out, and it didn't wait for a response. So the problem with Sapphire was that it was sending out so many packets and it was infecting so many hosts simultaneously. All the different versions of Sapphire were doing this, that it ran out of bandwidth on the entire internet to propagate itself because it was just that efficient. And Sapphire may have been based on Warhol. I'll get to Warhol in a bit. Which would be, if it's true, the first example in the real world of a Warhol worm. The interesting thing about Sapphire is that it propagated to 90% of all infectable hosts in the first 10 minutes. After that, it was, you know, it was just the little things. It was taking up the little things. But really, so if Sapphire was smarter, it should have probably stopped infecting after 10 minutes. It should have just stopped. But that's part of the stupidity of worms, is that they just keep on going until they infect themselves out of existence. Sapphire was also nice in that it didn't leave any, it was purely in memory, it didn't leave anything on disk, and so you had to use a special program to determine if you were infected by Sapphire. With most of the worms, you can just look. You can look in your web logs, or you can look on your file system, and it'll leave traces that it's there. And so the downside of this is that if you reboot a computer with Sapphire, then it's no longer infected because it was only kept in memory. However, because it infects so rapidly, you'll be infected in a couple of minutes anyway. And Sapphire is another one of the examples of a worm which was totally benign, didn't really do anything but propagate, but because it propagated far too much, it caused a lot of sluggishness on the internet. Also had a bad random number generator, so that was bad. Okay, Stumbler, also known as 55808 or Typot. This is not actually a worm, this is just, it's a Trojan, but it's the first distributed scanner, which is something I ought to come back to later, is distributed scanning. And that's another very brilliant one. I really love Stumbler. And the way that it worked was, you have this Trojan running on a bunch of different Linux machines, and it sends out packets with a particular TCP window size, and a random destination address and a spoofed source address. So there are TCP SYN packets. So if the destination exists, it sends back an ACK, which it doesn't actually get back to the worm because it was a spoofed source address. But the important thing is that you have all of these SYN packets going out and never coming back all over the internet, and the local versions of Stumbler will see the TCP window size and say, oh look, that's one of the packets from one of my brethren worms, and then it will record that and then gather statistics, you know, scanning the internet, and then send all of that information to somebody, to a fixed IP address. Now, the problem with this is that it's really easy to detect if you have Stumbler traffic because it has this unique window size. And the reason it has this unique TCP window size is because you need some way to identify, the Stumbler worm needs some way to identify traffic that's specifically destined, you know, sent to it. And I'm going to get into later a better way to do that, which is much more efficient. Okay, so Warhol worms. Warhol is a theoretical worm design, which may, you know, we may have found an instance of it in Sapphire, but it has many different aspects. The basic idea behind a Warhol worm is that you can infect most of the internet really very quickly in about 15 minutes, say, by building up a hit list previous to when you infect. Normally worms, they spread slowly. You infect a couple people, they infect a couple people, they infect a couple people, and it grows exponentially. But if you could start with a hit list of, say, 50,000 hosts that you'd already scanned and you already know what operating system they're running and what vulnerabilities they're vulnerable to, you just take that list, give it to the worm, send it to those people first, and then your initial propagation only takes about 10 minutes, and then you can go for the rest of the things. And we can see that in Sapphire that, in fact, it only took about 10 minutes. So there's some other additional things that were in the original Warhol paper that are worthy of note. Another one is permutation scanning, which is a more bandwidth efficient way than random scanning, which is that you do random scanning, but everybody starts out with the same seed, and you just take and you start in a random place in the list, and then you scan until you hit another worm instance, and then you say, oh, well, I don't want to scan there anymore because obviously that worm instance has got the rest past there, and then you start at a new random point and you scan until you find another worm instance. And Warhol also suggests that you should periodically rescan the network for two reasons. One, obviously new machines are coming up all the time. There's churn happening in the network, and you want to make sure that everybody's still infected. And additionally, every time you do one of these permutation scans, at the end of it, when you stop, it's because you found somebody that's already infected. And so if you do this, you can keep a list of some of the other people that are already infected. You can first have a link to whoever you last found on your last scan, where you stopped your permutation scan and said, okay, this person's infected. And additionally, whenever anyone permutation scans you, then you can say, oh, I'm already infected. By the way, I'm going to remember your IP address so that I know what other worms are out there. And Warhol also suggests that you should fall back to subnet scanning, but only when you have exhausted all of your internet scans, because internet scans are more profitable, because subnet scans, many subnets they're behind NAT, basically all the worms there are equal. You only need multiple worms in a subnet for backup purposes. You really want to propagate over the internet. But if your internet scans are being limited because you're running out of bandwidth, then you should go ahead and fall back to subnet scanning. Warhol was also the first worm to introduce the idea of allowing the person that deploys the worm to update the worm dynamically by sending signed code updates. Okay, Flash. Flash was a somewhat minor improvement on Warhol. They looked at the Warhol design. This is also just a theoretical design. They looked at the design and they said, okay, 15 minutes. Well, I think that we could do it faster. I think that we could propagate in about 30 seconds. And their scheme is you make a very, very big hit list. You make a hit list with pretty much every single machine which is vulnerable to the exploit that you have on the internet. And they have several ways that they suggest that you could do this. One is to have just a very large site with a whole lot of bandwidth and just have it do it. They suggest that with a big enough site, you could scan the whole internet in 2 hours. I don't know about that. Another solution is a distributed scanner. Much like where you have distributed denial of service attacks using a bunch of compromised zombie machines, you could use those to scan to try to build up a comprehensive list. Additionally, you could do a very slow scan that takes several months and is therefore could be very stealthy. It'll fade into the background traffic because people are getting scanned all the time. You could also use a web spidering technique. That would, especially if you have a web server vulnerability, well, you only want to hit all the machines with web servers anyway, so you use web spidering, and people are always spidering the web for various reasons. All the search engines do it, random people do it. So the technique now, once you have this hit list, they suggest that if you had a hit list of several million IP addresses, it would be maybe, you know, like 48 megs or something like that. And that what you do is you put it up on a really big site with lots of bandwidth. And then each worm, as it's created, divvies up the portion of the master list between the previous worm and itself. They take the two lists and they divide them in half. And then you figure out what your range of the list is. You go out to this big site, and you download your portion of the list, and then you infect all of those machines. And so they say they could infect the whole internet in 30 seconds. I don't know about that, but that's not important. I'm just telling you what exists already, so we can get to the new stuff. Okay, so then there's Curious Yellow. Curious Yellow is my worm design that I wrote, and the reason that I wrote this is because in the Warhol paper, the author of the paper says, I'm sorry, it wasn't in the Warhol paper, it was in David Moore's paper, How to Own the Internet in Your Spare Time, which is all about designing good worms. He says that you could have a coordinated worm where all the different worm instances talk to each other about which machines they should propagate, and they decide, and then one person takes this machine and one person takes this machine, and you don't have duplicated effort. But nobody's done that yet because it was too hard. So I decided that I'd do that. And so I wrote this worm design called Curious Yellow, and the paper's on the internet. So anyway, it's the first coordinated worm. And there's Slapper, for instance, coordinates after the fact. The worms get together and you can use them to do things. But Curious Yellow is the first one where they coordinate during the infection process. And the benefit of this is that it eliminates overzealous propagation. You're not going to have this thing with Code Red where you have all these people hitting your logs. You're going to have one person hit your log, and it'll just fade into the background because you'll never see it again. Because the whole infection space is divvied up among all of the worms. So the more worms you have, the smaller space of infection each of them is in charge of. So everything gets distributed nicely. Now, I'm going to get into the algorithm for that later, but it's based on another algorithm I made called ACORD, which is an anonymous variant of CORD. Now, CORD is a distributed hash table. This is the key thing that I'm going to be talking about later, is distributed hash tables, or DHTs, as we like to call them. Because my theory is that distributed hash tables are really the key thing in making coordinated distributed worms. Okay, and let's see. I guess I'll go ahead and skip on over to the distributed hash table stuff. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give an overview of the necessary distributed hash table technologies you need to understand in order to understand these crazy coordinated worms. Oh, but first I'm going to give you my points on my manifesto. There we go. Okay. The Superworm Manifesto. These are my points about how to make delicious, good worms. If I could just find it in my notes. Okay. So, there's, I think, two slides in here that are not in the book or on the CD. It's there's this one and there's another minor slide. But anyway, so these are the lessons that we've learned from the existing worms. Let me go over here so I can peek at my slides for that show. Okay, multi-platforms. Well, you could say both multi-platforms and multi-vectors, you can kind of sum up as many cooperating worm strains. You don't necessarily have to have just one worm. The important thing is that all the worms interoperate on the infection process. You can have some that, you know, go through email because email penetrates corporate firewalls and NAT. That's very handy. And you can have another strain of the worm that goes ahead and, you know, propagates over IIS vulnerability. And if you have multiple different strains, you can keep them all very small. The important thing is that they all have this core, this distributed hash table core, which allows them to talk to each other. And the algorithms I'm going to be showing, I think that they could probably even fit into something as small as Sapphire. They're really very, very simple. Okay, so the next is the basic scheme is propagate, sleep, mutate, and then repeat, which goes in with delayed gratification. A big problem with worms today is that they just kind of burst out there. They just take over and then everything gets sluggish and then couple things crash and they denial of service Amazon and then they're gone and they just burn out. If you want to have a really, really interesting worm, then what you need to do is propagate it slowly and then deploy new exploits, update the code with some new exploits, let it propagate further until you have everything. You have the whole internet. You have as many machines as you could ever think would ever have vulnerabilities, and you have worms on all of them. And nobody's noticed it because you haven't done anything. They're just kind of, you know, sleeping there. Then you get to the really good stuff. Let's see. And that goes along with updatable exploits. I think that you're going to have much better propagation if you can add new targets to your list over time. And updatable worm logic, that's where things get really interesting, because you can, after you deploy the worm, then you can decide what you're going to do with it. You have a really good idea for something fun to do to the internet, well, you know, you just go ahead and deploy your update. And I have an algorithm in here I'm going to show you which does super fast updates. You can update your whole worm network in somewhere from like 8 seconds to 3 minutes, depending on various factors. Let's see. So then build the initial hit list. That's from Warhol and Flash. That's going to get you your fast initial propagation. And then distribute scanning. So you can use a distributed scanner in the first place using, you know, manually compromised zombie machines. But once you have the worm network deployed, that's a really good basis for a distributed scanning network. You just deploy a code update. You tell all your worm instances, okay, I would now like you to scan everyone on the internet for this, you know, particular operating system and this particular patch level and everything, so I can use this exploit that I just found that I'm so excited about. And because the whole space of internet is divided among the worms, you know, each one's going to choose an IP and it's going to scan it, and you're going to have just one scan, and it's just fade into the background noise and not be very noticeable. And this is going to let you build up your secondary hit list, so you can deploy, you know, to a whole new operating system that you didn't even think to do in the first place. And let's see. Okay, context-aware propagation. This is about how you shouldn't just keep on. After the first 10 minutes of a Warhol-type worm, you stop, because you know that you've already propagated to 90% of the hosts, so you don't need to go crazy. You can slow down. Additionally, you should use a different scheme for subnet propagation than for over-the-internet propagation. There are a lot of stupid worms out there that will just try to just use random addresses, and some of them don't exist, and some of them are subnets, and some of them are broadcast addresses, and it's a big mess. You know, you should be aware of the context that you're in, that goes in with multi-vector. If you can't get behind a firewall, then you should go to an email or web route. Let's see, if you're on a very high bandwidth site, you should go ahead and do a lot of spewing while you have the time before somebody knows you, because, you know, high bandwidth sites, under more scrutiny, you want to get out of there as fast as possible. Let's see. Okay, cover traffic with existing traffic. This is, for instance, in the case of Stumbler. It has that problem that, well, it's good that it's using just TCP SYNs, because, you know, nobody's going to really notice about, you know, a few stray ones. They're not that big a deal. Definitely less obvious than Code Red. With Code Red, it has this particular crazy string that nobody would ever request, and everybody's requesting it, and you're like, oh, it must be a worm. TCP SYNs, oh, who knows? They come from everywhere all the time. But it has that particular window size so that you can write this little trivial little script that says, oh, look, somebody said to use Stumbler traffic. And so it'd be best if you didn't do that. Make your traffic look just exactly like everybody else's traffic as much as you can, and keep it down to a minimal level, not the crazy bandwidth usage, so that nobody knows that anything's going on. It's just background noise. And let's see. And this all really goes down to coordination between worm instances. This is the key to my whole scheme for designing superworms, is to have the worm instances talk to each other so that they don't have to do these things like setting the TCP window size. You can just know who you're getting packets from. Okay, next. All right, so CORD. CORD is the first distributed hash table scheme I'm going to talk about, because it is the simplest. It's kind of the basis of everything. It was invented by a bunch of guys at MIT, including Robert Morris, who some of you may have heard of. And I think that's kind of funny. But anyway, so CORD, this is my first slide of CORD. This is not actually CORD. It's a little bit more complicated, but I thought I'd take you through some steps. So basically, you give every node, and nodes in this case are instances of the worm, you give them an ID. And the important thing about these IDs is that they shouldn't be able to choose them themselves. They should be unique. They should be evenly distributed. They should be random. Something like that. So I like to use hashes of IP addresses. Now, this in particular situations with the particular attackers is a bad idea. But I feel that if you design a worm which is so good that people are looking at the algorithms that it uses in order to try to trick it, that you're pretty good. So we'll just use hashes of IP addresses. And so every node has a next pointer, which is the person whose ID is closest to mine but greater than mine. In core, this is just basically clockwise distance around the ring. So after 0 is 1, and after 15 is 0, and so on. Now, in actual core, you're using like SHA-1 hashes, which are 160 bits. But I kept it down to 4 bits, because it makes much nicer graphs. And also, normally in a real actual network, this is going to be all gappy. You're not going to have exactly 16 nodes in your 4-bit network. You're going to have something much smaller than the total number of nodes, and they're not going to be nice and evenly distributed, but this makes nicer pictures. So just imagine that this ideal network is being overlaid in a kind of best fit to some terrible, messy network. Okay, so you've got the basic idea, which is that you've got your next pointer. Now, so this means, I should back up, a distributed hash table is basically a hash table. And that may not make sense how this relates to worms yet, but I'm going to get back to it. So hash table, as we all should know, is you give it a key and it gives you back a value. And in the case of distributed hash tables, you give it a key and it gives you back a node who you would talk to about getting that value. So in the simplest version of CORD here, let's say you start at like, say, 7 and you want to get to 14. That's your key is 14. All you do is you just go to the next pointer, the next pointer, the next pointer, the next pointer, until you get, to your destination. Now that's of course not very exciting, and so we'll go to the next slide, which is an optimization on top of CORD. Okay, so to get just a slightly bit crazier, you just go ahead and keep what we call a finger table, which is pointers to people elsewhere in the network other than your next pointer. And in this case, we're just like, one hop away. And in that case, let's say if you're at 1 and you want to go to 4, you can skip right over 2, hop right to 3, and then go to 4. Now, CORD keeps log n of these finger table pointers, each of which is 2 to the x away, x being 1 to n, right? So you're like, okay, what node is right in front of me? And which is 2 away, which is 4 away, which is 16 away, which is 32 away. And so you have this nice picture, and it looks something like this. Yes. No. Okay. There we go. And so you have this nice picture, and the nice thing about this is that you can get to anywhere in the network in log n hops, which is which is pretty good. There's some other stuff I'm going to show you in a bit, which is better, but this is pretty good. So here's an example of me looking up something that's so beautiful, and you. Let's see. And the red lines are the hops, right? So every hop takes you halfway across the network, and then halfway across the main network, and halfway across the main network, and you get to anywhere really fast. And this is going to come up later when I'm talking about how to propagate things to some particular node really fast. Okay, so that's CORD. That's the basis. Basically, every distributed hash table algorithm is basically some variant of CORD. Because the CORD people wrote this, everybody got really excited, and then a bunch of people wrote various variants of them. Now, so a couple things about how this relates to writing worms, first off. First of all, every worm now has a place in this, it has a place. It has neighbors that are defined that it needs to keep track of. And the neighbors, they're not so many. It's log n of the total size of the network. Certainly better than a fully connected graph, which would just be just plain silly. And so every worm has its own ID space. So for instance, 0 is in charge of everything between 0 and 1, which isn't all that much, but, and 1 is between everything between 1 and 2. So what you do is you partition the space of all possible hosts that you might want to infect, which is basically all IP addresses, you partition them among the existing nodes. And the add and join protocol says that if there's a new node created, you just find its ID, which is you hash its IP address, and then you find its ID, and then you just stick it in this network. Now the way that you find where to go is you just find any node. Like let's say I have 3.5, which you really wouldn't have 3.5. But let's just say I did, I wanted to stick it in the network. And let's say the node that created me is 13. So all I do is I go to 13 and I say, hi, I'm 3.5. Could you please look up that key for me? And it does a normal lookup, which is that it goes from 13 to 0, 0 to 2, 2 to 3. And then it says, okay, your neighbor is 3. And then 3.5 connects to 3 and 4 and sticks itself in there and then divides its space between half the space of 3 and half the space of 4. And now 3 and 4 and 3.5 all know exactly which ranges of IP addresses they're supposed to be infecting. And everybody has their place, and everybody's doing their own job, and there's no overlap between anybody else. And additionally, there's a couple of tweaks you can do to add Byzantine fault tolerance, Byzantine-style fault tolerance, to the network so that you never have to worry about somebody being left out. You don't have to worry about there being some kind of unstable, inconsistent state in the network. Yeah? Okay, so Byzantine fault tolerance, all I mean is that so if there's some disruption to the network, if you worry about there's an inconsistency, like for instance either an accidental inconsistency, like somebody dropped out of the network and the protocol for adding and joining didn't take care of them properly, or let's say there's an evil node in the network which is trying to misroute you, and like let's say if zero is evil and it says, oh, the person after me is 740 and it's a big mess. The way you deal with that with Byzantine fault tolerance is you just, every time you're traversing a link, you actually have three people, and you ask all three of them, okay, what's the next link in this graph? And then you take the 2 out of 3 majority answer. If all three disagree, then it's a big mess and you should give up. And also, if one of them disagrees, then you know he's evil. And you could possibly do something about that, but probably not in a worm, because that would be too much code and be hard to do in assembly. So back to everybody's got a place, everybody knows which range of addresses they're in charge of. So the only thing that you need to worry about now is how do you keep consistent the people on either side of you so that you know that you've got the right range of addresses, you're not overlapping with anybody else. Now this is a problem because of churn, which is that there's people being, you know, especially with worms, there's going to be a lot of churn because there's going to be people actively trying to delete your nodes, you know, off of their machines. That, you know, they don't want them there. I guess that's understandable. And you know, then there's going to be new nodes created all the time. Now, of course, once you get to like 90% of the network, which with a Warhol worm is only going to be like 10 minutes, it's going to be kind of stable because you've got 90% of the nodes. You know, so in terms of additions, you're not going to have that many new additions. But when you get a new exploit and you propagate your new exploit and suddenly you've got all the OS 10 machines that you didn't even have before, then you know, you're going to have a whole bunch of new people that you're going to have to add. And you need to have a way to do this that doesn't eat up more bandwidth than Code Red was eating up. Now in this particular case, you have 160 people that you need to keep track of, and there's 160 people that need to keep track of you. And those aren't the same people, so that's kind of a mess. Because you're having to go out to these 160 people and say, okay, are you the person I'm supposed to be talking to? And then they have to look up the person you're supposed to be talking to and then give you their address. So the traffic to keep this up to date is something like log n times log n, which isn't so good. We could do better. And so I'm going to show you my next design here, because this is really the key. I mean, this is what we're doing, is we're trying to I don't need this slide anymore. This just demonstrates that these are your outward neighbors are blue, and these are your inward neighbors are red. And so as you look, cord is pretty symmetric that way. But you know, you don't get any overlapping neighbors. So here's this other thing called Kademlia. And so as I was saying, the point is that you want to minimize the traffic. That's the whole idea. We're going to coordinate worms to minimize traffic. So updating the network, you also need to minimize traffic there. So with Kademlia, it's basically the same thing as Cord. They think that they're all cool because they wrote like a separate paper, but it's just a little tweak. And here's what it is. It's instead of using this clockwise distance, you use exclusive OR, which is like every programmer's like favorite thing in the whole universe. So it's good that it actually works out here, so you get to use exclusive OR. So what you do is you take your address in bits, and you take some other node's address in bits, and you exclusive OR them, and then you get a new number, which is the same number of bits. So like, for instance, in Kademlia, it's like Cord, it's a 160-bit number. And this is the distance from you, is the exclusive OR of your address and their address. And then you store the same kind of finger table as cord. You say, okay, who has an address which is closest to being my address plus 2, my address plus 4, my address plus 16, et cetera. And so you end up with this thing. It looks, the first one looks a lot like cord, but they look different as you progress through. But the interesting thing here is that I color these purple because they're both ingoing and outgoing, because unlike clockwise distance around a ring, exclusive OR is symmetric. The exclusive OR of A and B is the same as exclusive OR of B and A, and it's beautiful. So the great thing here is not only do you have less connections overall, you have, instead of having 2 log n, you have just the log n. But additionally, because your ingoing and your outgoing are the same, if you've got any traffic whatsoever, if anybody's doing any kind of lookups or anything, then they kind of auto-update the network. You don't have to specifically go out and say, okay, update, you know, finger table entry 0, update finger table entry 1, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anytime you get traffic in, if you don't have a link to that person, then one of two things is happening. A, you should have a link to that person. They're the new person, and get rid of the old person who is in finger table slot X and put this new person in there because they're the person you should be talking to. Or they shouldn't be talking to you. They should be talking to somebody else entirely. You can tell that if they're farther away from, you know, the ideal number for that slot than the person who's currently in that slot, then that means that they shouldn't be talking to you, which means they're probably evil, which means that you should probably just refuse to talk to them or pretend that you're, you know, a web server or something to throw them off the scent. So that's really handy because your bandwidth needed to update the network, if you have traffic going on, if you have people talking, is basically zero. If you have nobody talking and it's totally dead, then you know you still have to do the thing where you go to each person, log in people, and you say, okay, are you the person I'm supposed to be talking to? And then they have to do a lookup. So the worst case is the same, but in a general case, it's going to be a lot better. But I could do way, way better. And here's another picture of Kademlia because it's pretty. Okay, here we go, cord. Don't worry, this is the last of my distributed hash tables. I'm going through all these different things because what I want to demonstrate to you is I wrote my Curious Yellow paper about, you know, worms using distributed hash tables. I don't know, like a year ago, 2 years ago. It was at the first international summit of peer-to-peer technologies or something over at MIT. That's where they published that paper. Since then, all of these new distributed hash tables have come out with all of these amazing, beautiful properties. This has just been in like the last year. So I feel like this is an area which is blooming rapidly and that things are going to get all crazy real soon. And that's going to be real crazy for the superworms. So this is cord, which is another variant of cord. Everything's pretty much a variant of cord. And it has the coolest distance metric I have ever heard of. What you do to go from your address to the key is you take your address in bits, you take the key's address in bits. You shift your address over to the left by 1 bit. Then you take the top bit off of the key, you pop it off, and you stick it in the slot where you just made space for a bit. And so after, you know, if you have like, you know, 160 bits, then that means that there's 160 operations before you shift all the way from your address to the key's address. And so what this means is that you only need 2 neighbors, because there's only 2 possibilities for the next guy. You shift your bits over, and then you take the keys bit and you put it in. That's going to either be a 0 or a 1. So you have a connection to somebody whose address is the same as your shifted over 1 to the left and then a 0, and then somebody else whose address is the same as your shifted over 1 and then a 1. So you only have to talk to 2 people. Additionally, you only have to update 2 people. It's just really, really handy. Now, you might want to add in some fault tolerance because it seems probable to me that both of these guys, even though they're just random people on the internet, it seems probable to me that both of them could, you know, get shut down. Like one could, you know, be rebooted and the other one could be disinfected. And so you might want to add some fault tolerance. There's another variant of cord which is, you know, crazy that adds all kinds of fault tolerance, but that's not important here. Now, shockingly, this distributed hash table implementation that only needs 2 neighbors will still look up anything in only log n time, the same as Chord, which needs log n neighbors. So in just a year, we've progressed from Chord, which was really cool, and I was totally in love with it, to this other thing, which is also pronounced Chord, but spelled differently, which is obviously pretty much better in every way. So next year and the year after that, I don't know, it's going to get crazy. I'm hoping for something that merges all the goodness of the second Chord with the goodness of Kademlia, to have something where you have few neighbors and they're auto-updated. And I'm sure somebody could work on that, but nobody's gotten around to it. And there's, you know, there's like 10 other distributed hash table implementations. Okay, so to reiterate kind of my basic Superworm design philosophy, is that what you do is you get a whole lot of nodes infected. And the way you do this is that you use a Warhol-like technique to get them out there real fast, and then you update them, use them in a distributed scanner to find a new hit list, update them with new exploits, and then propagate them to the new hit list. Then you scan for a new hit list, you get a new exploit, you propagate to that, until you get just a whole lot of people, and all these people are sleeping quietly, they're not doing any damage, they're just propagating, they're doing like one hit to this guy, one hit to this guy, nobody knows what's going on. And you link them up with a big distributed hash table so they all know about everybody else. So here is my really excellent, exciting algorithm where you get to do all kinds of crazy stuff. After I go through, there we go. So this is my distributed hash table algorithm. It's called Pollen, and it's the basis of Curious Yellow. And so it's a little confusing at first, but I'm going to explain how it works. Okay, so what this is for, this is not actually a distributed hash table. This is something that you do on top of Chord. Chord, your distributed hash table. I'll probably do a version on Kademlia later because it's cool. But so what this does is it flattens the distributed hash table graph into a tree, where in this case the top of the tree is the node on top. And it does it into a tree so that what you do is you take your new exploit or your new worm logic or whatever, your update to your code, and you send it out and it propagates to the entire network with no duplication. Nobody gets it twice, so you don't have to worry about generating a lot of traffic because each node only downloads it once. And you can distribute your new thing in, depending on the starting node and how much bandwidth it has, between like 8 seconds and 3 minutes for, I don't remember, I think it was like 128K patch. And so this is the basis of Curious Yellow. So the way it works is really simple. If you look, the number of outgoing connections is the same as the number of finger table entries you have. So in a normal Chord network, it'd be 160. In my handy little looks good version, you have four bit addresses, and so you have four finger table entries. So the first node, its number is 4, because you start with 4, the number of entries you have. And you make a number of outgoing connections in Pollen equal to your number. So for instance, the first node, whose number is 4, makes 4 outgoing connections. And each of those connections, what they do is they take the number of the node before it, and then they subtract from it the number of the connections. So the first connection it makes, the big one, that's connection 1. And then the smaller arc is connection 2, the smaller arc is 3, and then the last one is 4. So if you see, for instance, the node at the very bottom, that takes 4, it subtracts 1, which is the size of that connection, and it gets 3. And then that node makes 3 connections following the same thing, and then one of its connections will make 0, one will make 1, one will make 2, etc. And that may be kind of confusing, but I bet if you just go ahead and look at it in the book later, that it'll all just become clear if you just kind of trace it out. So the upshot of this algorithm is the very, very fast propagation of updates. And the effect of this fast propagation of updates is that you can't really outrun Curious Yellow by patching your vulnerabilities, because before you can patch your vulnerability, the exploit will have already been distributed. So like a new exploit comes out, and you're all like, oh look, there's this new exploit, and I know there's this Curious Yellow thing running around, I hope it doesn't infect my machine, I better patch this new vulnerability Well, it's already been infected because 8 seconds after the worm author wrote up his his exploit code, he went ahead and deployed it. And yeah, maybe he should bug test it, but why bother? It only takes 8 seconds to deploy. He'll just do the beta version, beta test it on 12 million nodes. Okay, bug fix. 8 seconds later, try the new version. And in fact, you'll see that with Slapper C, it was just bug fixes for Slapper B. But they had a very less efficient way of doing it, which is they released a new worm, Slapper C, which then competed with Slapper B. This way you have all of the worm instances coordinating, and you can keep them up to date with all the best exploits, all the best bug fixes. Okay, so...
Why are you re-exploiting boxes that you already own?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean re-exploiting boxes that you already own. I meant exploiting new boxes that you didn't have an exploit for previously. Because that's the idea, is that you keep exploiting new people as you keep finding new exploits until you have everybody. And then when you have everybody, then you can do the fun stuff. Okay, so this is my fun with Superworm slide. Okay, first of all, an anonymizer. This is key. This is really key. Because let's say you make this ultimate Superworm and you own the whole internet and nobody can stop you. Probably not. But let's say you did. Okay, well, what they're going to do is they're going to find you and they're going to beat you. And they're going to say, I want the private key so that I can send an update to all of these people. Well, hypothetically, you could send an update to all the worms saying to delete themselves. But, if you've got the private key and there's like all these infected nodes, you could do other stuff. We'll just leave that to how moral you think the various powers that can find this guy are. So really, you need an anonymizer. You need a way, because as you're sending these patches out, sure, they're getting out fast, but they could trace you. All they have to do is watch the traffic. You got enough power, you're high enough up, you can trace the people. You got a nice anonymizer. You've already got all these nodes, and they're all connected. I've designed anonymizers on top of DHTs before. It's not that big a deal. I think that that should be your first step, really, if you're designing Superworm, is to anonymize all your traffic. I know there was the story I read about this guy who made this worm in the UK, and I don't know what it was called because he never released it, he never did anything with it, nobody really heard about it, but they tracked him down because he was controlling his worm instances via IRC. They all joined this IRC channel. I know there's another one called Linux Dev Null that did the same thing, and he's doing fine now. I don't think he went to prison because he didn't do anything malicious, but... that's just silly. Don't control them via IRC. Control them via, through an anonymizer, via this crazy peer-to-peer thing. Okay, so the next thing is, you can find a host nearby to somebody you want to mess with. That's like that story, that old myth about how somebody calls 911 and they're like, I'm getting these obscene, scary phone calls, and then the operator's like, the call's coming from inside the house. It's like somebody's hacking you and you're like, oh, where's this hacking? Oh, it's coming from inside our subnet. Oh my God, it's scary. That'd be pretty fun. So let's see, next thing, silent denial of service. I got two variations. This is my favorite. Okay, so everybody knows that what you do when you have a worm is either denial of service your friends are mad at on their IRC servers, shut down their IRC servers, or you go after like Amazon, eBay, somebody where you can be like, oh, remember when Amazon went down? That was me. That was my worm. That's what people do with, Okay, so I've got a new kind of distributed denial of service attack, because they're always coming up with crazy new different distributed denial of service attacks, right? So mine is the silent distributed denial of service attack. I've got two variants. The key thing to the silent distributed denial of service attack is that you don't denial of service the website. Like, let's say Amazon, right? Sure, you can have your 12 million worm instances all hit Amazon with traffic, and yeah, it's going to go down, but that's not a very efficient use of a really, really widespread worm. What you do is you just monitor packets, and when somebody makes a connection to Amazon, you just spoof a reply. You're like, hi, Amazon. Yeah. there you go. That's the whispering silent denial service. The screaming denial service is, let's say that doesn't work. So anytime anybody sends a packet to Amazon, then what you do is you crash their machine. Let's say you're higher upstream and you got a bunch of people that are all trying to go to Amazon. What you do is just generate a lot of traffic right there, upstream on your nice upstream node, and then everything gets clogged up and nobody. And so what happens is Amazon's like, why aren't we getting any hits? I mean, it's secure. Nobody's denial of servicing us, so that one's fine. And as long as you're going to be messing with web traffic, you got the man in the middle. You know, you can do all kinds of fun man in the middle of stuff. You can steal people's credit card numbers and their SSH passwords and fun stuff like that. Because, you know, you're on the network, you can spoof stuff and you can, you know, eavesdrop on stuff. Let's see. Oh, gathering cool stats. Imagine if you had like 12 million computers that you owned. You know, you could have like a graph which is like total part of the internet that I control. You know? That would be cool. You know, you could see like, you know, what operating systems you have and what operating systems you don't have yet and that kind of thing. I just think that would be, if I had a superworm, that's what I would do. I think it'd be fun. And then the last thing is you can crash the internet over and over and over again. Normal worms, maybe if you had a good Warhol or Flash worm, you'd be able to crash the internet. Now the problem with crashing the internet is that it's really boring. Like the Morris worm was a pretty cool worm. It kind of sucked, but it was pretty cool. And it crashed the internet, or so I hear. I wasn't alive then, but you know, that's what I hear. And then it was back up, and that's boring. Well, so the good thing is, okay, so here's what you do if you want to crash the internet and then crash it again later, right? What you do is you have your whole network, right? And you deploy a code update that says, okay, all you nodes, I want you to bifurcate into two separate autonomous networks. Then you crash the first network. And that's going to be so many nodes, that's pretty much going to crash the internet. Then they get all the nodes back up, and then you say to the second network, okay, reinfect those guys, I got a new exploit. Or probably the exploit will still be there. They probably just rebooted the server because, you know, that's what we find out from Slapper and Code Red too. And so let's say maybe you actually crash the whole thing. You crash all your nodes. You just have them all generate lots of traffic, and then the whole internet goes down, and then they wipe all your nodes. Well, all you got to do is find one new exploit that, you know, hasn't been patched yet, and you can just redeploy all over again. You know, and then you just keep doing this, and really. So this is where I talk about what I think you could do to stop a worm like this. Now everybody always gets mad when I talk about stopping the worm, because they're all like, your solution's terrible. It's worse than the problem. But I don't think it is. And so what I want to do is have this other thing called Curious Blue, which uses this algorithm. Now I'm not talking about a white worm, as they say, because you don't actually need to propagate it as a worm. You just could tell people, hey, install this. And what it does is it uses this algorithm. It links everybody that has Curious Blue, it links them all into one big network. And when the vulnerability is discovered, somebody writes a patch that fixes it, and then boom, 8 seconds later, everybody's got it. And then you're in a race between the people that write exploits and the people that write patches. Now, I think that's good. You know, I mean, people that write exploits, I think that they generally tend to find them faster, but not always. Sometimes, you know, the people find the patch first, and I think you'd be in a better solution. Now people say to me, well, what's going to happen if you do this is that somebody's going to just send out an evil patch which just installs a backdoor, and then Curious Blue becomes Curious Yellow again. And what I say is, well, you know, that's actually not any worse than our current updating mechanisms, in my opinion. This is controversial, but this is how I feel. With manual updates, it's not as if you actually look at it and make sure it's good. You just you know, assume that it's good. And maybe you have some digital signatures going on, and that's great. Well, you know, this would have digital signatures too. So it's basically the same thing, only it's faster. Being faster doesn't make it more vulnerable. Being faster just makes it a more attractive target to try to hack into. But really, if you're going to have any kind of updating, especially auto non-manual updating, you know, you need to have a very secure system with digital signatures, and nobody should ever be able to break into your system and get the private key. And if they do, then whatever you're doing with the updates, it's all screwed. They're gonna mess you. I mean, and this has happened. You know, this happened with Debian. There was like a Trojan Debian package, and everybody was mad. And you know, it happens every now and then. And the other thing I have to say about my solution is, every other solution that someone has come up with as an alternative was just silly, you know? Like, they're like, okay, well, if you had IP version 6, then, you know, you couldn't do this scanning thing because it'd be way too many IP addresses to scan. I'm like, oh, okay, well, if we had IP version 6, that'd be good. And they're like, well, okay, we're gonna eliminate buffer overflows, you know? That would be great. Then people can't use buffer overflows anymore. I'm like, well, I'll believe that buffer overflows will be eliminated when I have IP version 6, you know? So I feel like basically the only thing that I can think of which is going to help is a really fast way to get patches out there. David Moore, who wrote How to Own the Internet in Your Spare Time, well, you know, like with his crew over there, he has this idea of making this like organization for disease control for the internet and has all these different parts. And basically what it all comes down to is a really fast patch updater, but with, you know, like a bunch more words. So I think that my algorithm's good. You know, somebody wanted to fund that, it would keep me from designing Superworm. Okay, let's see. Here's my contact information and stuff. I work for the Foundation for Decentralization Research. They don't actually sponsor this work, and they didn't send me here. But they're cool, so I thought you might want to check them out. And then they're hard to read is my paper. It's not a very good paper, because I just wrote it because it seemed kind of trivial that if you want to make a coordinated worm, you take distributed hash tables and you put them together. So it was just like this weekend thing I did. A lot of people get mad at me. They're like, why are you out here telling us how to make these crazy super worms? And I said, well, if you know about distributed hash tables, it's a trivial application to write a super worm. So I just thought I'd go ahead and tell people they didn't know so that they would know before somebody else figures out who's like mean and stuff. Okay, so that's all my slides. So I'll take some questions. I got 15 minutes for questions. You guys better have some questions after all that material. Oh yeah, that's a good question. So basically, oh, I'm sorry, repeat the question. There's a sign, but I couldn't see it because my laptop's on top of it. Okay, the question is, how do you deal with NATed IP address space? It's the same way that you deal with corporate firewalls. They're the same thing. They don't want to let you in, so you can't just like connect to the servers inside. You can if you have port forwarding, but as all peer-to-peer developers know, no one has port forwarding set up. Nobody. If they did, all our file transfers would be faster, it'd be so much awesomer, but they don't. So what you do is, if you have to get in there, they don't want to let you make incoming connections, is that you have to go for the email or web Trojan sort of thing, so that you know, a person actually goes out and they bring it through, they have to pull it through, and then once you're there, then you can make outgoing connections, and you can switch to your normal scheme.
But with your distributed hash table, then right.
Yeah, so there's the question of how does my distributed hash table work behind NAT? That's a very good question. I didn't actually think to make a slide of that, but I use distributed hash tables for a whole bunch of different applications, internet radio and all kinds of crazy stuff, getting around that Chinese firewall that's so annoying. And basically what you do is, there are two classes of people in a lot of these situations. There's the people that can be part of the network and the people that can't. Like, for instance, with the Chinese firewall, if you're in America or, you know, some other place that's not behind the Chinese firewall, you can be part of the network. But if you're behind the Chinese firewall, just forget about it. You know, they can spoof both ways. It's a big mess. So what you do is you take the people who can be part of the network, who are in this case the people that aren't behind NAT, and you make them part of the network. And so you have the ring of those people. So just imagine, let me get to the picture of the ring so I can better visualize these. There we go. So imagine this ring consists of only the people who are not behind a firewall. Now, what you do with the people who are behind a firewall is you take their IP address as reported by the firewall, not their local IP address, right? But like their, you know, their internet-wide IP address. You look them up, you find which node, you know, is the node that they would be partnering with if they could be part of the network, and you just kind of attach it on as a leech. And so what you end up with is you end up with this ring with kind of spikes going out all over the place. And so basically, the nodes that are part of the ring take care of all of the work, and the nodes behind firewall just kind of leech. They're just like, hey, anybody call for me lately? Do I have any messages? Should I be scanning anybody? And then, you know, that node takes care of them. And I don't know. I find that with voluntary peer-to-peer networks, you end up with actually like 90% of people behind NAT, and like only 10% of people aren't behind NAT. But that's okay, because that's still a whole lot of people, if you think about it, that aren't behind NAT. And the people that are behind NAT are evenly distributed around the ring. So there's no like leeching center. It's like just kind of even leeching. Does that answer your question?
Wouldn't those nodes try to infect the same people over and over again?
Oh, see, that's what I'm saying is that the nodes that are behind that, they're responsible for the nodes that are not behind that that they're attached to do all the work. So they'll say, okay, like, you know, okay, who should I be talking to here? You know, which node should I be infecting? Basically, the people behind that just kind of act as like a distributed worker pool for the guy who's not behind that. So he tells them what to do and then they do it. And, you know, there you go. That's basically it. Okay. I saw a question over here at some point. Maybe it was about the same thing. Yeah? No, actually, they're all mathematically based. They're all, you know, it's those guys at MIT, and they all have a lot of proofs. Are you talking about in terms of real world? Yeah. Yes, in fact, the CORD, the second CORD paper with the K, CORD, that paper was the first paper that I've read which proved some of the boundaries of like, for instance, I think they said something about how the best you can get is log n hops. You really can't get any better than log n hops to any particular destination. That's, in general, that's the CORD paper is just really fascinating. One thing, though, that they have not really done is talk about them in terms of real-world applications. Like, there's this one really fascinating distributed hash table based on a butterfly network, which is this crazy hypercube thing. And it's beautiful because if you destroy 99% of the nodes, 99% of the remaining nodes can get to 99% of the other nodes. So it stays connected even in when you're just like going crazy attacker on it. The problem with that, of course, is that the internet isn't actually, the physical internet that it's overlaid on isn't nearly as robust as that, and so it doesn't actually work. Because there's no, I mean, it would work only if you made this thing where it was this fully connected graph that it was on top of. And so, recently, with the, like CORD, for instance, has this big problem with churn. It's just probably, I mean, maybe it would work, but I think that probably in most scenarios it probably wouldn't work because the churn of hosts on the internet is greater than CORD can handle. And so the new algorithms that have been dealing with churn better, that's kind of more approaching the real world thing, but basically they just haven't had much testing, and that's because they're, you know, they're all about proving some algorithms, and that's cool. Yeah. Yes, that is actually one of the approaches that I forgot that wasn't insane. Right, it was basically IDS. I think that was David Moore also suggested that, and that was probably his best idea. I don't really have anything to say about IDS and worms. I think that it would probably work pretty well, but I don't have kind of this faith in IDS. Like, I think that basically it's kind of an arms race with you try to figure out what's okay, and then I try to figure out how to make something that looks okay, that you think is okay, but really it's, you know, it's still me being terrible. And in fact, there's, you know, I could recommend this really great science fiction novel about the IDS war, except I can't remember the name at the moment, but maybe I could tell you later. So I think it would be interesting to try that out. I think that would be fun. That's about all I have to say. Yeah.
In this ring, if you start, because it's sparse initially, there's space between all.
Yeah.
If you start adding a lot of hosts, you have to reallocate all the hash tables to find out who your neighbors are. I mean, like, let's say all of the new hosts show up in between 2 and 3.
Right. That doesn't happen because of the fact that the hosts are randomly distributed, because it's the hash of the IP address. And even though IP addresses aren't all that random, hashes of IP addresses are pretty well distributed if you're using a hash which, you know, distributes things well. So you won't end up with that kind of general hash table problem that you have where it's all unbalanced and you have to rebalance it. Things are going to be pretty balanced. But yes, if you do have a massive influx of people, you're going to have to do a lot of updating. And that's why things where you have to do less updating in general are good. There are probably some edge cases where if you have a whole bunch of people leave at one time, or if you have a whole bunch of people come in at one time, that things can get permanently out of whack. And that's some research that people have kind of been doing, but haven't really, it hasn't really matured yet, as far as I'm concerned. But it's probably going to be better than you think it is.
Can you manage the special addresses like
Right. Yeah, that's well. Okay, so I have two things to say about that. One is that that's a problem with a lot of worms is they don't think about special addresses. And when you're making your worm, you should have it, you know, think about that. For instance, you should treat subnet addresses totally different than you treat internet addresses. For your subnet, you form one network, your subnet network. You can use the same algorithm. It'll probably work fine on a really small network. And then you have, you know, your separate network for your internet network. Because they're not related, you know, they're two separate worlds. And for multicast, I think that unless, now, it was kind of cool with Sapphire because sometimes it would hit multicast addresses, and because it had this one way, I give you a UDP packet, you get it, you're infected, when it would hit broadcast addresses, everybody would get it and they'd all be infected, and it was so great. But you know, that wasn't intentional. They were just hitting random addresses. And so I think, say, if you're using a TCP-based, you know, mechanism, you should not hit those. You should ignore the special addresses because people will notice if you're hitting non-existent addresses or addresses that you just shouldn't be trying to hit. You know, like if you're using 192.168 on like a 10.0 network, they're going to notice that. They're going to be like, this is weird, and you shouldn't, you know, do that. So the other question that I think I heard in your question is if the non-homogeneousness of the allocation of IP addresses messes up the distributed hash table thing. And I don't know. That's a good thing. For the Pollen, which was the broadcast algorithm, I'm writing a paper for some conference with a friend, and we're doing some simulations. That's something that I'll simulate there, is how unbalanced it is. But if it was unbalanced, you could easily make a simple hash function that, you know, distributes things, you know, evenly and ignores those special addresses and still evenly distributes everything. That would be pretty easy to do. Yeah, this makes your worm a little bit more complicated, but, you know.
Are you aware of any worm approach with
the By worm approach, do you mean self-propagating, or do you mean my distributed hash table stuff? Both? Oh, okay. I think that the self-propagating thing kind of went out of distributed computing with the whole agents fad. Now, I apologize if there's any people that hear this that are still think that agents are cool, but I pretty much think that anybody that says agents needs to, you know, go take a nap. Yeah, the whole mobile code thing just doesn't seem to be the trendy thing anymore. And now when you say grid computing and peer-to-peer are like these two like feuding cousins, right? And I come from the peer-to-peer world, which is a bunch of crazy guys with long hair sit on IRC and, you know, like trade files and stuff. And there's the grid computing people who, as far as I can tell, are doing kind of the same thing, except that they don't want to let us use their servers, you know? They're like, we have a bunch of servers and we're processing astronomical data. Or like, can we put MP3s on those? And they're like, no, you know? And is that my time thing? Oh, okay. So there's these two, but basically it seems like we're doing pretty much the same stuff, except that peer-to-peer is about cheap stuff, cable modem and, you know, like, Celerons and that kind of thing, whereas grid computing is about like fairly big machines with fiber and all that kind of stuff. And because of that, grid computing is kind of more static. It doesn't really need a need for distributed hash tables because you're not adding and removing people. You've kind of got your people and you leave them there. And I tried to get some people interested in using like distributed hash tables for data storage, like backup networks where you can just pop in a new machine and it'll rebalance all your files and that sort of thing. And nobody was really interested. So as far as I can tell, no.
I think one scenario where the grid are machines that can be taken over by the world.
Okay, wait, sorry, are you saying we could use Curious Yellow and all of the computers over the internet to like link them together into one big distributed processing cluster? Is that what you're saying? Because that's pretty cool. And the thing with that is that in terms of using like desktop machines, like normal consumer machines, which is when I think about the internet, that's mostly what I think about. I know there's all that other stuff, but it doesn't really apply to me. The problem is everybody comes up with these like distributed processing ideas, and then they can't really find anything to distributedly process. And it's because of this trade-off between bandwidth and processing power is such that it's really oftentimes, for most problems, not that profitable. That's why you have things like distributed.net, right, which try to crack like RC4 encryption. It's because RC4 encryption cracking is one of those things that's really well suited to that kind of thing, because you have all these processing cycles, and then the answer is like, yeah, I got it, or no, I didn't get it. And so you have very little, you know, bandwidth utilization. But for a lot of like the grid computing stuff, they actually need to transfer lots of, you know, information back and forth between people. So I mean, basically you got your protein folding and your SETI at home, and then you got your your RC4 stuff. And so people keep, when peer-to-peer was big, they were like, okay, let's do some distributed processing, but then nobody thought of anything to do with it. I think maybe if you had that many computers though, you'd be able to think of something cool to do. I'll think about that. Yeah. That is a great question. Yes. It depends on your ID allocation scheme. In my ID allocation scheme, which is based on IP addresses, if you get a new IP address, you're new. You're a new node. You're just a whole different place in the network. Now, for most people with DHCP leases, this happens rarely enough that it's kind of lost in the overall churn of people coming and going. But for other uses of distributed hash tables, like for instance storing files, it's a big mess, because if you have several gigs of files, you don't want to suddenly be somebody else and then have to get rid of all your files and get a whole new set of files, and you know, it's a big mess. Now, the whole hash of IPs thing, I get a lot of criticism for that, and I use that because it was easy, you know, and I mean, I'm not trying to personally write the greatest, you know, superworm of all time, because I mean, what do I get out of that? Nobody's gonna be nice to me or give me money or anything. It's just they're gonna be mean to me. So there are better. The ID allocation totally depends on your attacker. Depends on what you care about. For the China problem, I have a different scheme. You know, for internet radio, I have a different scheme. Okay, can you make one more question? Yes.
How do you limit what you're going after? Let's say you're not trying to get everything. You're missing corporations.
Okay, so you're saying how do you target only certain individuals?
You're worried about people's privacy.
Oh.
Not worried about others.
Okay, so let's say you want to only attack part of the internet.
Right.
Well, if there's any way that you can, port map that machine and figure out if it's a good person or a bad person, then there you go. You just, you know, put that code in all your worms and you say, okay, all my, and you can change it any time. You know, you got that 8 seconds and then boom, it's a whole new game. You say, okay, worms, figure this out and only infect these people. Or you could say, for instance, infect them, see if they have any child porn, and if they don't, delete yourself, something like that, you know? You know, because once you're in the machine, you got all this really great, you know, stuff you can do to figure out like what kind of person they are, like what operating system they're running and what patch level and, you know, what they have installed, all that kind of thing, because you know you're in their machine, you have all the access. So okay, I'm out of time. Thanks everybody.